Hello, this is Janice Schweizer with the Pantograph for Tuesday, March 25th, 2025. We begin on the first page with a boutique fit for every size. Heinz fulfills her dream, sees Simply Stone grow in Pontiac by Drew Zimmerman. While in high school and college, Jennifer Heinz loved the rapidly changing demands of working in retail at stores like Maurice's. It was different every day, she said. I like getting to meet with customers and help pick out outfits and all that stuff. However, she never saw herself as having a career in the industry, so she began teaching agriculture education at Normal Community High School after college. And although this wasn't the right fit for her as a full-time career, Heinz said her love of boutique shopping in small businesses grew. And I always kind of said in the back of my mind that I would love to do this someday. Her dream was eventually realized with the August 2023 opening of Simply Stone Boutique, which is one of the newest women-owned businesses. The Pantograph will feature this month in recognition of Women's History Month. Heinz, who grew up in Pontiac but currently lives in Chenoa, said when she first started out, she wanted to make sure women of all sizes felt there was something for them. That was one of my big driving factors, is that I wanted to be somewhere where everyone could come and shop and find something without having to go to the curvy section in the back corner, she said. After starting online, Heinz eventually found a space at 205 West Madison Street in downtown Pontiac that she shared with a local photographer. She later took over the whole space and expanded to offer more than just clothing. The recently remodeled store now sells clothing, as well as special items like candles and dip mixes. Although there are multiple boutiques within a couple of blocks from her store, including Charmed Boutique and Livin' in Color, Heinz said each business tries to support each other instead of being in competition with one another. She added that Donna Comans, owner of Livin' in Color, in particular, helps to send customer her way and vice versa. We both try to send each other either way because I'm kind of down here on my lonesome, whereas the block down there is a little bit busier. So they just see a little bit more traffic day to day, Heinz said. Over the next year, Heinz said she hopes to spread the word about her business and let people know she offers items in a wide variety of sizes. Looking 5 years out, I would love to just kind of have more inventory, more options, and maybe get into something other than women's clothing. But I don't know, Heinz said. We'll just have to see how it goes. Simply Stone Boutique is open from 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. Wednesday through Friday and from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Saturday. For more information on Simply Stone Boutique or to shop online, visit simplystoneboutique.com. Also on the front page, we have Red Tape Holds Up Campus Buildings. State budgeted $2.9 billion in 2019, but progress is frustrating. This is by Ryan Greiser with the Saluki Local Reporting Lab. Buildings on Illinois' college campuses were falling apart when lawmakers approved a $2.9 billion raise for higher education construction as part of the 2019 Rebuild Illinois Capital Plan. The funding brought hope for long overdue upgrades, but the slow rollout has left colleges in limbo. 5 years later, half of the 16 promised projects are still tied up in planning. It's been slow and it's been frustrating at times, said Matt Bierman, Vice President of Business Affairs at Eastern Illinois University, which is planning to build a new science building with its funding. A series of setbacks have stalled progress, including staffing issues at the Capital Development Board, the state's construction management agency, rising post-pandemic construction costs, and local disputes over how to stretch funding that no longer covers what university officials originally planned. Construction costs shot up nearly 40% by 2023 compared with pre-pandemic levels, according to Associated Builders and Contractors. We lost about $30 million in buying power, said Mark Luer, dean of the College of Pharmacy at Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville. We just couldn't get everything we wanted in the original concept. SIUE was able to build its health sciences building, but it came with major changes to the original plan. We started making trade-offs like, well, we really need this. If we're going to cut back, let's cut back in these areas, Luer said. SIU Carbondale faced a similar problem with plans to fully renovate its 1960s-era communications building on the Carbondale campus, with roughly $85 million allocated from Rebuild Illinois. By the time they set out to finalize the design, officials no longer had enough funds to do what they'd originally planned. SIU leaders initially had asked lawmakers for additional money, but when it didn't come, they started moving forward with a scaled-down design, according to Hong Chen, dean of the College of Arts and Media. Lately, state officials have sought to provide some relief. The Illinois Board of Higher Education's 2025 budget included $575 million to help schools affected by rising costs see their projects to fruition. For 2026, the board is urging lawmakers to carry over any unspent funds and speed up project approvals to ensure those under Rebuild Illinois are completed within the six-year time frame, according to IBHE spokesperson Jose Garcia. The state itself has also faced challenges to completing these projects. The Capital Development Board oversees all major projects to ensure contractors, designers, and builders stay within budget and meet state requirements. But the agency's staff has been overwhelmed by the surge of projects created under Rebuild Illinois. There's a lot of projects, and they can't be accomplished all at once because it's got to go through the CDB, said Bierman, the EIU administrator. The university has faced delays in redesigning its planned new science building to match the new funding reality, in part because the state lacks the resources to move quickly. He expects EIU to complete the project by 2029, a decade after the state passed Rebuild Illinois. The agency reported in 2023 that many projects fell behind schedule due to a wave of retirements, according to a public accountability report in the Illinois Comptroller's website. Tamikia Edwards, who was appointed executive director of the Capital Development Board in May after the retirement of her predecessor, said in an interview she and her staff are looking for ways to ensure projects stay on track. That includes efforts to beef up the agency's current workforce of about 160 who oversee all legal, financial, and planning aspects of hundreds of projects. We have 658 projects in all phases of project delivery, Edwards said. We're constantly looking at process improvements, how to do things better and faster, and how to mitigate risk. Those are constant conversations I'm having with our team. The pandemic created workforce challenges, she said, but Edwards cautioned that even under the best circumstances, projects take a long time to complete. It's not like funds are appropriated on Monday and then we're out the gate in 30 days doing the project, she said. There are also unforeseen challenges and design and scope development and prioritization changes. There's a lot of things that are happening behind the scenes throughout the life cycle of a project. Edwards noted that while the project planning process can be lengthy, construction has been moving quickly once projects go to bid. Luer, who is overseeing the project at SIUE, found this to be true. The pandemic slowed the design phase of it, but it didn't slow the construction. Once we got to the point of putting it out for bid, it all moved really quickly. Luer said he anticipates SIUE's construction to wrap up this spring and for the building to host its first classes with the start of the fall semester in August. The SIUE School of Pharmacy, which has been in temporary facilities since its formation in 2004, will finally have a home once the new building opens. Luer said it's been a long haul, and he and others on the Edwardsville campus are eager for the project's completion. I'm just looking forward to what we can imagine we're going to be able to do with facilities that are actually designed for the purposes that we're going to be able to use them for, he said. Southern Illinois University in Carbondale and Eastern Illinois University will have to wait several more years for their projects to become reality. SIU Carbondale will receive nearly $15 million in addition to its original $84 million allocation for the communications building. Officials see that as good news, but it also means more design work and further delays. While Bierman said EIU is grateful for the project, it's also been a challenging process. Nearly a quarter century will have passed by the time officials expect construction on the science building to wrap up. I don't know how much longer they're going to stay ahead of the curve in terms of getting something designed that's going to meet today's needs, Bierman said. The process for requesting state funding for building renovations and repairs isn't flexible. Once a project is identified as a priority, he said, it's difficult to change plans. While universities can shift priorities before selection and appropriation, they cannot reallocate funds from one project to another. Going forward, EIU hopes to focus on renovating existing spaces rather than building new ones. He also urged state lawmakers to provide more consistent state capital funding for universities rather than focusing their efforts on only a few large-scale projects. According to IBHE data, public universities across Illinois face more than $8.3 billion in deferred maintenance. This backlog of neglected repairs, leaks, mold remediation, heating and cooling repairs, and other issues that worsen as aging buildings deteriorate has nearly tripled over the past two decades. While many buildings at state universities hold historical value, officials say they are becoming obstacles to recruitment. Declining enrollment and budget shortfalls make it harder to maintain aging buildings, creating a vicious cycle. We want renovation dollars. We want to fix what we have instead of a building that somebody can put a shovel in the ground for a press release. We want something that's practical, Bierman said. Edwards of the Capital Development Board acknowledged the reality of the aging infrastructure and said there is near constant discussion and strategizing about how to address the problem. We have some rich history in our buildings across the state, and we want to preserve that history and take care of our assets, she said. In another article about government buildings, we have Livingston County settles suit over building, also by Drew Zimmerman. After being stuck in litigation for the last 6 years, Livingston County has reached a settlement agreement with a contractor responsible for the design and construction of the county's Law and Justice Center. The county entered a contract with Dewberry in September 2009 for the design and construction of the Livingston County Law and Justice Center at 1220 North Main Street in Pontiac. The project was budgeted at about $20 million. Dewberry's compensation for basic service was a lump sum of $1.5 million, with an additional $164,000 in compensation for on-site construction observation services. Although work was substantially completed in 2 years, the county received a letter from the Illinois Office of the Attorney General alleging 99 violations of the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Illinois Accessibility Code that required correction. For example, as the Pantograph previously reported, a person with disabilities called to testify in any of the three courtrooms faced a 7-inch single-step barrier before entering the witness stand. Livingston County officials disputed some of the findings, but also required Dewberry's contractors to correct some of the issues and develop design solutions for other violations. The county eventually settled with the Office of the Attorney General to resolve 39 remaining issues, which included insufficient maneuvering space at the east entrance and limited wheelchair space in courtroom galleries and jury boxes. But in September 2019, the county filed a lawsuit against Dewberry, alleging they were at fault for 33 of the 39 code violations. Both parties agreed to delay litigation several times over the following years As they work to determine the scope of needed repairs and identify possible alternative solutions. During this time, the Livingston County Board accepted a $536,000 bid from Vissering Construction of Streeter to perform ADA renovations to the building. Although the litigation continued in 2023, Dewberry filed a counterclaim against Livingston County. Both denied any liability for claims asserted by the other party. In February, the parties participated in a settlement conference and ultimately reached an agreement. Dewberry will pay the county $400,000 and both parties will dismiss their lawsuits with prejudice, meaning they cannot be refiled, according to court documents. Parties will pay their own attorney's fees. The Livingston County Board approved the settlement agreement during its March 13th meeting. Alina Hartley, Executive Director of the Livingston County Board Office, said the agreement included a non-disclosure clause, so she could not comment on the case. Brendan Dennison writes, Ecology Action Center calls for volunteers to plant 10,000 trees. Normal's Ecology Action Center is seeking help with getting 10,000 new trees to take root in 2025 in McLean County. The EAC said it needs people's time and financial support to reaching its annual tree planting goal this year. Over the past 3 years, those forms of assistance have aided EAC in the planting of more than 30,000 trees. This spring, the EAC has planned several tree planting projects, including at Kamlara Park and Lake Bloomington. The center is also working with the Illinois Department of Transportation on projects near the Market Street and Veterans Parkway interchanges. The environmental nonprofit stated trees reduce air pollution, sequester carbon emissions, create habitats for wildlife and pollinators, cool urban areas, and protect local watersheds. The Ecology Action Center said it is targeting urban areas for planting where trees are needed most for air quality and other benefits to help increase tree equity. To sign up for a volunteer shift or make a donation, go online to tree-corps.org, or for more information, call the Ecology Action Center at 309-454-3169. Next, we'll read Preparing for Tornadoes, Know What Causes Twisters, and How to Decipher Watches and Warnings. When severe weather hits the U.S., there are ways people across the country can prepare for the potential impact of hail, rain, damaging wind, and more. Tornadoes can take down power for thousands of people, cause catastrophic property damage, and kill. The U.S. sees about 1,200 tornadoes each year. Experts say watching forecasts and knowing the meaning of different stages of warnings are key to safety. Here's what to know about the causes for these storms and the alerts for watches, warnings, and emergencies. The large areas of low atmospheric pressure that come with some storm systems can spawn tornadoes. Low pressure is associated with stormy weather, and the lower it is, the stronger a storm can be. Low pressure systems draw air into them, creating those rains and winds. In the spring, fall, and even winter, we get these really strong, what we call extratropical low pressure systems, said Victor Gensini, a professor of atmospheric sciences at Northern Illinois University. These are just storm systems that occur in the mid-latitudes of each of the hemispheres. If you think about a map of the United States and you draw a big U across the map, that would be a big trough, he said. That big trough, helps promote the creation of this area of low pressure and strong storm system. These storm systems cause very strong winds and hail. Combine that with the side of the low-pressure storm system that has warm and humid air that wants to rise, and there is a possibility of thunderstorms. In the right conditions, warm, moist air close to the ground, cooler, dry air above, and wind changes, the storms could lead to tornadoes, according to the National Weather Service. In that type of atmosphere, where it's warm down low and cold aloft, and it's also humid down low, you can get air to rise through thunderstorm updrafts at a pretty good clip. And that leads to potentially severe weather, said Paul Markowski, a professor of meteorology at Penn State University. Usually, the stronger the thunderstorm updraft, the updraft is just the term for where the air is rising, the more potential you have for things like damaging winds, hail, and potentially even tornadoes. The other ingredient you need in addition to that temperature variation with height is what's called wind shear, he said. This is the term that refers to how much the winds change as you go from the lower atmosphere to the upper atmosphere. The Weather Service's Storm Prediction Center issues a tornado watch in an area up to 10 hours ahead of a storm when conditions suggest possible tornadoes. People in that area, which usually covers several counties or states, should then be prepared for potential warnings. A warning is issued by local forecast offices when weather radar indicates a tornado is coming or was seen. This typically encompasses a small area, such as a city or county. People in the area need to take action, such as moving to a shelter on the lowest floor of a building and avoiding windows. Tornado emergencies are the Weather Service's highest alert and are issued when a tornado has touched down in an area and catastrophic damage has been confirmed. They are rare but require immediate shelter in place. People should have multiple ways to get watches and warnings and know the definitions of each, experts say. Weather radios can be especially helpful if power is lost and TV and ordinary radios no longer work. It's also important to have safe, enclosed, and underground shelters or rooms above ground that are equipped to handle tornado-level winds prepared in advance. In a lot of the parts of the country affected by tornadoes, there is no underground option, Markowski said. You're not going to be any better off leaving your house, frankly. So if you're in your house, just put as many walls between you and the tornado as you can. Get away from the windows. An interior room, like a bathroom, is a good spot. Here we have repayment plans in limbo. What to know about changes to student loan debt programs. The Trump administration's recent changes to student loan programs are causing frustration and confusion for some borrowers. In response to a February court ruling that blocked some Biden-era programs, the Education Department took down online and paper applications for income-driven repayment plans. This especially hurts anyone who's lost their jobs, including federal workers, said Natalia Abarus, founder and president of the Student Debt Crisis Center. A few months ago, they would have been able to get on a $0 income-driven repayment plan. The removal of application materials also caused confusion about the recertification process for borrowers already enrolled in repayment plans, experts say. Income-driven repayment plans take a borrower's finances and family size into account when calculating monthly payments, but borrowers must periodically demonstrate that they still qualify. Adding to the uncertainty are layoffs at the Education Department, which oversees the federal loan system. The federal website for student loans and financial aid, studentaid.gov, suffered an hours-long outage on Wednesday, but the department said it will continue to deliver on its commitments. It's been wave after wave of bad news for student borrowers, said Aisa Canchola-Banez, policy director at the Student Borrower Protection Center. Here is some guidance for those with student loans. All borrowers currently enrolled in income-driven repayment plans should get a sense of when your recertification deadline is and get a sense of what options are available to you if the form is not available online to recertify your income, Banez said. Recertification confirms a borrower's financial situation. With some forms not currently available, borrowers who are unable to complete that process could be in jeopardy. If borrowers are on an income-driven repayment plan, they should be allowed to remain on that repayment plan if they are able to recertify their income. Abrams said it's a good idea to take screenshots of your account's current status on the Student Aid website. State-specific and state-level resources are available for student borrowers. Congress members have teams charged with helping constituents if they are having trouble with a federal agency or struggling to contact a federal student loan servicer. Borrowers may contact their representatives in Congress and open a casework file by visiting their website or calling their office. Try saying something like, quote, I need your help to understand how to get an affordable repayment option, which I'm entitled to under the law, close quote. Even though this federal department has taken down these applications, I need your help. Despite the timing of the Education Department and President Donald Trump's dismantling of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, loan services still must consider a borrower's financial situation, Banez said. You can see if you can get temporary forbearance or a deferment of payments for financial hardship. State attorneys general also take inquiries from student borrowers. Jessica Fugate, 42, a government relations manager for the city of Los Angeles, said she was less than a year from student loan forgiveness under the Biden-era Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, which forgives outstanding loans after 120 payments. With the court challenge to her former SAVE payment plan, Fugate hoped to switch to an income-driven plan before Trump took office. She applied in January. With income-driven repayment plans in limbo, she isn't sure what her options are. And when I called recently, the machine said there was a four-hour wait. I've spent most of my career giving back to other people. I don't mind serving people. I just feel this was an agreement they made with the public, and so we're owed that. And it's a lot of us, and we're not just numbers. Debbie Breen, 56, works at an agency on healthy aging in Spokane, Washington. Breen said she has worked in the nonprofit sector for more than 10 years, and nearly all those years counted toward public service loan forgiveness. Breen was also on the Biden-era SAVE plan, which means she was placed in forbearance when the court challenge to that plan was upheld. Like Fugate, she planned to switch to an income-driven repayment plan to have her payments count toward forgiveness. I'm kind of in panic mode because I know that if they stop income-driven repayment plans, I don't know what I'm going to be able to afford the payments each month. Breen says she has two kids who also have student loans. And in today's Flick Fact, we have more than a dozen streets in Bloomington Normal are named after U.S. presidents. And there's even one president who has his first name on one side of Center Street and his last name on the other side. Do you know the president and where his first and last names are adjoined? The answer is Woodrow Wilson, our 28th president from 1913 to 1921. When traveling south on Main or Center Street, at an intersection just south of Hovey Avenue, to the west is Woodrow Avenue, and to the east is Wilson Street. Thanks to Diana Hallman of Bloomington for this gem. And with that, we conclude the reading of Part 1 of the Pantograph for Tuesday, March 25th, 2025. I'm Janice Schweizer, and I will return shortly with Part 2.